Listen. Can you hear them? Voices. A multitude of voices. Some whispering, some shouting, and some even screaming.
Listen to them.
They all have something to say. Don't listen too closely. You might not like what you hear.
Broken Sea Audio Productions presents the third annual Halloween audio season. Voices in the Dead of Night. Coming October 2009 to BrokenSea.com.
SFFAudio.com. The sound of tomorrow. Explore the limitless worlds of the imagination with SFFAudio.com. Reviews and features, audiobooks, online audio, full cast audio drama and radio theater. The ultimate source for news from the world of science fiction and fantasy audio, brought to you by the most trusted team in the business. SFFAudio.com. The future never sounded so good.
Broken Sea Audio Production, OTR Swag Cast.
This new app of Broken Seas, who's going to knock everyone's socks off?
Doctor? Doctor?
No.
And George returns!
Can't be here.
Yes! Woohoo!
George!
Love when Dave plays Georgie.
You're dead.
Yes. Yes, I am.
What the bloody... My audio mix! It's fine up until the doctor, Mac talks to George. And then it's gone! Lost all Paul's credits in the climax.
Right. But where are we? Transylvania. Late 19th century. Carpathian Mountain.
Wait, what's this?
Well, I guess I'd better have a look, old girl.
What the...
Oh, it's quite cold for October. Now, where's my... Oh, where's my sonic...
Hello, Mark Colita.
Hello, young lady. Mark who? Oh... Him! The audio fella, Broken Sea and all that.
Weird! It sounds like the TARDISes. Holy Cybermen! It is! It's in me, Bleeding Studio!
You're Draven. Yes.
Hey, Stevie. Sorry about your mix. Mark and I had some... business to discuss with Pookie.
Draven? Pookie? Well, where's Bill? How did you get from West Texas to England?
TARDIS.
Oh, yeah. Right. But what are you doing here?
Hosting the final episode of the Halloween Swagcast. I need you to introduce Horror of the Worlds. It did first air on October 31st, you know. Orson was cool like that. Then we get Dracula also by Orson and Mercury as well as a special classic monster treat. So get to introducing War of the Worlds now!
But I kind of got to mix Broken Seas Doctor Who, Draven. Where's Bill?
Never you mind. I mean it.
Draven, I don't think Bill would...
Okay, you asked for it. Kyra!
Kyra? Your sister's here too? Wait, who's that coming out of Max TARDIS?
Kyra the Dalek, 2.0.
Your sister's a Dalek?
Exterminate!
A Dalek?
Host show or be exterminated.
Okay, here you goes.
Hiya folks, this is Stevie K. Farnaby, stepping in for Uncle Bill to introduce what has to be one of the greatest all-time OTR classics. A few weeks ago, Bill asked me if there was any particular show that I would like to hear on the Swagcast, and this one came immediately to mind. If ever there was an OTR show that was worthy of legendary status, then this one very definitely would be it. I am of course referring to the 1938 Orson Welles Mercury Theatre production of H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds. I'm pretty sure I don't need to go into just how much of an icon George Orson Welles was. But one thing you may not know was that he was actually an accomplished magician too, who starred in many, many troop variety spectacles in the war years. He also co-founded Mercury Theatre after he resigned from the Federal Theatre towards the end of 1937. War of the Worlds was first broadcast on October the 30th, 1938, and it brought Orson Welles notoriety and instant fame on both a national and international level. Its mix of news bulletin format and between breaks created widespread confusion amongst especially listeners. Panic spread amongst many listeners who actually believed the news reports were of an actual Martian invasion. The resulting panic was actually duly reported all around the world. And oddly enough, Adolf Hitler himself even referred to the broadcast in a public speech he gave several months later. As a prolific producer and director of audio drama and radio plays myself, I can honestly say that I would not have gotten involved with the medium if it wasn't for this particular production. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I give you one of the most inspirational and controversial radio plays you will ever hear. Orson Welles, War of the Worlds.
Thank you, Stevie. Oh, Kyra.
Yes, sir.
Now.
What? No, get back! Kyra the Dalek! No!
Hooligan Creepazoids, enjoy the show!
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Charles C. Shaw speaking. KTSA is honored this evening by the presence in our studios of two great men, the Honorable H.G. Wells, world-famous British historian, author, and student of world affairs, and Mr. Orson Welles, the genius of stage, screen, and radio. This is the first time that Mr. H.G. Wells and Mr. Orson Welles have appeared together. In fact, they met for the first time only yesterday here in San Antonio. But this is not the first time that their names have been linked. 2 years ago, Mr. Orson Welles adapted Mr. H.G. Wells' book, War of the Worlds, for radio purposes, and you know the rest. Revising the story somewhat, Mr. Orson Welles depicted an invasion of the United States by men from Mars. Although he explained at numerous times during the program that it was fictitious, the country at large was frightened almost out of its wits. Men called radio stations offering to enlist against the Martians. Others were panic-stricken. The realism of the production, frightening though it was a tribute to Mr. Orson Welles' genius. And thus the name of Welles, H.G.W.E.L.L.S. and Orson W.E.L.L.E.S. became linked. Mr. H.G. Welles, in the opinion of many, is the world's most famous man of letters. He has come to San Antonio to address the United States Brewers Association, and Mr. Orson Welles is here for a town hall forum address Wednesday. In this meeting of great minds, I feel rather inconspicuous, and the less I have to say, the better you listeners will like it. But first, could I interest you gentlemen in a discussion of Mr. Orson Welles' broadcast of Mr. H.G. Welles' book, The War of the Worlds?
You're turning the meeting over to us, sir?
I am, for the moment.
He's turning it over to us. Well, I've had a series of the most delightful experiences since I came to America. But the best thing that has happened so far is meeting my little namesake here, Orson. I find him the most delightful carrier. He carries my name and an extra E that I hope he'll drop sooner or later. See no sense in it. And I've known his work before he made this sensational Halloween spree. Are you sure there was such a panic in America, or wasn't it your Halloween fun?
I think that's the nicest thing that a man from England could possibly say about the men from Mars. Well, Mr. Hitler made a good deal of sport of it, you know, actually spoke of it in the great Munich speech, you know. And there were floats in Nazi parades.
Much else to say.
That's right. Much else to say. And it's supposed to show the corrupt condition and decadent state of affairs in democracies that the War of the World went over as well as it did. I think it's very nice of Mr. Welles to say that not only I didn't mean it, but the American people didn't mean it.
That was our impression in England. We had articles about it, and people said, have you never heard of Halloween in America when everybody pretends to see ghosts?
Well, there was some excitement caused. I really can't belittle the amount that was caused, but I think that the people got over it very quickly,
What kind of excitement? Mr. H.G. Welles wants to know if the excitement wasn't the same kind of excitement that we extract from a practical joke in which somebody puts a sheet over his head and says, boo, I don't think anybody believes that that individual is a ghost, but we do scream and yell and rush down the hall. Mm-hmm. And that's just about what happened.
That's a very excellent description.
You aren't quite serious in America yet. You haven't got the war right under your chins. And the consequence is you can still play with ideas of terror and conflict.
You think that's good or bad?
It's a natural thing to do until you're right up against it.
So it ceases to be a game.
And then it ceases to be a game.
Well, now, here's a thought. Some of Mr. H.G. Wells' writings are termed fantastic, and a few years ago, well might they have been conceived such. The shape of things to come, which told of a long internecine war, was such a fantasy. But, Mr. Orson Welles, do you think that it's so fantastic in view of today's events?
It certainly is not so fantastic. And the one question that Mr. Welles has spoken of, not only in the shape of things to come, but has hinted at or directly prophesied such a state of affairs following a wasting war and a return to a feudalism from which the world would find itself again. And today in Mr. Welles' lecture, he said quite the most interesting thing that I've heard in a long time. He said that he'd commenced just recently to ask himself if there was any reason why mankind should so emulate the phoenix and should so get itself out of its mess. He proposed a couple of solutions, but he did admit that there was a possible excuse for a gloomy point of view, and that it would be good to be realistic about it and not to dismiss the gloomy point of view anymore. Perhaps the time had come to look ahead, since the future, Mr. Wells's future, which we've always adored and never really understood, is suddenly upon us.
Mm-hmm.
And we are living right now in that famous H.G. Wells future, which we all knew about.
Now, before we get away from this microphone, tell me about this film of yours that you've been producing. You're a producer, aren't you? You're
that's right.
Art director, you're everything.
Well, Mr. Wells...
What's the film called?
It's called Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane, yes. Not C-A-I-N.
No, K-A-N-E. And this
Kane.
Is, of course, the kindest and most gracious possible thing to do. Mr. Wells is making it possible for me to do what in America is spoken of as a plug. And he understands
do
this fine old American
I don't understand these words, yes.
Mm-hmm. You understand the value, however. Mr. Wells wants me to tell you that I have made a motion picture, and he is kind enough to ask me a leading question concerning it.
I'm looking forward to it.
You're very kind, sir. It's a new sort of motion picture with a new method of presentation and a few new technical experiments, a few new methods of telling a picture, not only from the point of view of writing, but of showing it.
If I don't misunderstand you completely, I think there'll be a lot of jolly good new noises in it.
I hope so. I think a few jolly good new noises are what the motion pictures could well afford these days. I hope you're right, and I hope there are some jolly good new noises. I can think of nothing more desirable in motion picture. I'm all for some jolly good new noises.
Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. Ladies and gentlemen, the director of the Mercury Theater and star of these broadcasts, Orson Welles.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's, yet as mortal as his own. We know now that as human beings busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied. Perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space. Yet across an immense ethereal gulf, minds that are to our minds as ours are to the beasts in the jungle, intellects vast, cool, and unsympathetic, regarded this earth with envious eyes and slowly and surely drew their plans against us. In the 39th year of the 20th century came the Great Disillusionment. Near the end of October, business was better. The war scare was over. More men were back at work. Sales were picking up. On this particular evening, October 30th, the Crosley Service estimated that 32 million people were listening in on radios.
24 hours, not much change in temperature. A slight atmospheric disturbance of undetermined origin is reported over Nova Scotia, causing a low-pressure area to move down rather rapidly over the northeastern states, bringing a forecast of rain accompanied by winds of light gale force. Maximum temperature 66, minimum 48. This weather report comes to you from the Government Weather Bureau. We take you now to the Meridian Room in the Hotel Park Plaza in downtown New York, where you will be entertained by the music of Raymond Raquello and his orchestra.
Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. From the Meridian Room in the Park Plaza Hotel in New York City, we bring you the music of Raymond Raquello and his orchestra. With a touch of the Spanish, Raymond Raquello leads off with La Campanita. Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity. Professor Pearson of the observatory at Princeton confirms Farrell's observation and describes the phenomenon as, quote, like a jet of blue flame shot from a gun, unquote. We now return you to the music of Ramon Raquello, playing for you in the Meridian Room of the Park Plaza Hotel, situated in downtown New York. Now a tune that never loses favor, the ever-popular Stardust, Raymond Raquello and his orchestra. Ladies and gentlemen, following on the news given in our bulletin a moment ago, the Government Meteorological Bureau has requested the large observatories of the country to keep an astronomical watch on any further disturbances occurring on the planet Mars. Due to the unusual nature of this occurrence, we have arranged an interview with a noted astronomer, Professor Pearson, who will give us his views on this event. In a few moments, we will take you to the Princeton Observatory at Princeton, New Jersey. We return you until then to the music of Ramon Raquello and his orchestra. We are ready now to take you to the Princeton Observatory at Princeton, where Carl Phillips, our commentator, will interview Professor Richard Pearson, famous astronomer. We take you now to Princeton, New Jersey.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Carl Phillips speaking to you from the observatory at Princeton. I'm standing in a large semicircular room, pitch black except for an oblong split in the ceiling. Through this opening, I can see a sprinkling of stars that cast a kind of frosty glow over the intricate mechanism of the huge telescope. The ticking sound you hear is the vibration of the clockwork. Professor Pearson stands directly above me on a small platform, peering through the giant lens. I ask you to be patient, ladies and gentlemen, during any delay that may arise during our interview. Besides the ceaseless watch of the heavens, Professor Pearson may be interrupted by telephone or other communications. During this period, he is in constant touch with the astronomical centers of the world. Professor, may I begin our questions?
Any time, Mr. Brooks.
Professor, would you please tell our radio audience exactly what you see as you observe the planet Mars through your telescope?
Nothing unusual at the moment, Mr. Phillips. A red disk swimming in a blue sea. Transverse stripes across the disk. Quite distinct now because Mars happens to be at the point nearest the Earth, in opposition, as we call it.
In your opinion, what do these transverse stripes signify, Professor Pearson?
Not canals, I can assure you, Mr. Phillips.
Thanks.
Although that's the popular conjecture of those who imagine Mars to be inhabited. From a scientific viewpoint, the stripes are merely the result of atmospheric conditions peculiar to the planet.
Then you're quite convinced, as a scientist, that living intelligence as we know it does not exist on Mars?
I'd say the chances against it are 1,000 to 1.
And yet, how do you account for these gas eruptions occurring on the surface of the planet at regular intervals?
Phillips, I cannot account for it.
Oh, by the way, Professor, for the benefit of our listeners, How far is Mars from the Earth?
Approximately 40 million miles.
Well, that seems a safe enough distance. Just a moment, ladies and gentlemen. Someone has just handed Professor Pearson a message. While he reads it, let me remind you that we are speaking to you from the observatory in Princeton, New Jersey, where we are interviewing the world-famous astronomer, Professor Pearson. One moment, please. Professor Pearson has passed me a message which he has just received. Professor, may I read the message to the listening audience?
Certainly.
Ladies and gentlemen, I shall read you a wire addressed to Professor Pearson from Dr. Gray of the Natural History Museum, New York. Quote, 9:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Seismograph registered shock of almost earthquake intensity occurring within a radius of 20 miles of Princeton. Please investigate. Signed, Lloyd Gray, Chief of Astronomical Division. Unquote. Professor Pearson, could this occurrence possibly have something to do with the disturbances observed on the planet Mars?
Hardly, Mr. Phillips. This is probably a meteorite of unusual size, and its arrival at this particular time is merely a coincidence. However, we shall conduct a search as soon as daylight permits.
Thank you, Professor. Ladies and gentlemen, for the past 10 minutes, we've been speaking to you from the observatory at Princeton, bringing you a special interview with Professor Pearson, noted astronomer. This is Carl Phillips speaking. We are returning you now to our New York studio.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is the latest bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News, Toronto, Canada. Professor Morris of Macmillan University reports observing a total of 3 explosions on the planet Mars between the hours of 7:45 p.m. and 9:20 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This confirms earlier reports received from American observatories. Now, nearer home, comes a special bulletin from Trenton, New Jersey. It is reported that at 8:50 p.m., a huge flaming object, believed to be a meteorite, fell on a farm in the neighborhood of Grover's Mill, New Jersey, 22 miles from Trenton. The flash in the sky was visible within a radius of several hundred miles, and the noise of the impact was heard as far north as Elizabeth. We have dispatched a special mobile unit to the scene, and we'll have our commentator, Carl Phillips, give you a word picture of the scene as soon as he can reach there from Princeton. In the meantime, we take you to the Hotel Martinet in Brooklyn, where Bobby Millett and his orchestra are offering a program of dance music. We take you now to Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Carl Phillips again, out at the Wilmot Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Professor Pearson and myself made the 11 miles from Princeton in 10 minutes. Well, I hardly know where to begin. To paint for you a word picture of a strange scene before my eyes, but something out of a modern Arabian night. Well, I just got here. I haven't had a chance to look around yet. I guess that's it. Yes, I guess that's the thing directly in front of me, half buried in a vast pit. Must have struck with terrific force. The ground is covered with splinters of a tree. It must have struck on its way down. But I can see the object itself doesn't look very much like a meteor, at least not the meteors I've seen. It looks more like a huge cylinder. Has a diameter of, what would you say, Professor Pearson?
What's that?
What would you say, what's the diameter of this?
About 30 yards.
About 30 yards. The metal on the sheath is, well, I've never seen anything like it. The color is sort of yellowish-white. The curious spectators now are pressing close to the object in spite of the efforts of the police to keep them back. Getting in front of my line of vision. Would you mind standing one side, please, while the police are pushing the crowd back? Here's Mr. Wilmot, owner of the farm here. He may have some interesting facts to add. Mr. Wilmot, would you please tell the radio audience as much as you remember of this rather unusual visitor that dropped in your backyard? Step closer, please. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Mr. Wilmot.
Well, I was listening to the radio.
Closer and louder, please.
Pardon me?
Louder, please, closer.
Yes. I was listening to the radio and kind of drowsy. That professor fellow was talking about Mars, so I was half chosen and half...
Yes, yes, Mr. Wilmot, and then what happened?
Well, as I was saying, I was listening to the radio kind of halfway.
Yes, Mr. Wilmot, and then you saw something.
Well, not first off. I heard something.
And what did you hear?
A hissing sound like this. Kind of like a 4th of July rocket.
Yes, then what?
I turned my head out the window and would have sworn I was asleep and dreaming.
Yes?
I seen a kind of greenish streak and then zingo. Something smacked the ground. Knocked me clear out of my chair.
Well, were you frightened, Mr. Wilbur?
Well, I ain't quite sure. I reckon I was kind of riled.
Well, thank you, Mr. Wilmot. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you want me to tell
No, that's quite all right. That's plenty. Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard Mr. Wilmot, owner of the farm, where this thing has fallen. I wish I could convey the atmosphere, the background of this fantastic scene. Hundreds of cars are parked in a field in back of us, and the police are trying to rope off the roadway leading into the farm, but it's no use. They're breaking right through. Car's headlights throw an enormous spotlight on the pit where the object's half buried. Now, some of the more daring souls now are venturing near the edge. The silhouette stand out against the metal sheen. One man wants to touch the thing. He's having an argument with the policeman. Now, the policeman wins. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there's something I haven't mentioned in all this excitement, but it's becoming more distinct. Perhaps you've caught it already on your radio. Listen, please. Do you hear it? The curious humming sound that seems to come from inside the object. I'll move the microphone nearer. Here. Now, we're not more than 25 feet away. Can you hear it now? Professor Pearson.
Yes, Mr. Brooks.
Can you tell us the meaning of that scraping noise inside the thing?
Possibly the unequal cooling of its surface.
I say, do you still think it's a meteor, Professor?
What do you think? The metal casing is definitely extraterrestrial. Not found on this Earth. Friction with the Earth's atmosphere usually tears holes in a meteorite. This thing is smooth, and you can see its cylindrical
shape.
Just a
minute. Something's happening. Ladies and gentlemen, this is terrific. This end of the thing is beginning to flake off. The top is beginning to rotate like a screw, and this thing must be hollow.
Move it!
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed. Wait a minute. Someone's crawling
someone
out
or something. I can see peering out of that black hole two luminous discs. The eyes, it might be a face, might be almost a... But heavens, something wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake. Now it's another one and another one and another one. They look like tentacles to me. Oh, yeah, I can see the thing's body. Now it's large. It's large as a bear. It glistens like wet leather, but face. Ladies and gentlemen, it's indescribable. I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it. It's so awful. The eyes are black and they gleam like a serpent. The mouth is a kind of V-shape with saliva dripping from its rimless lips. It seems to quiver and pulsate, and the monster or whatever it is can hardly move. It seems weighed down by possibly gravity or something. The thing's rising up now, and the crowd falls back. There seems plenty. The most extraordinary experience, ladies and gentlemen. I can't find words. Well, I'll pull this microphone with me as I talk. I'll have to stop the description until I can take a new position. Hold on, will you, please? I'll be right back in a minute.
We are bringing you an eyewitness account of what's happening on the Wilmoth Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. We now return you to Carl Phillips at Grover's Mill.
Ladies and gentlemen, am I on? Ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmot's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them. No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain's conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Oh, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side, studying the object while the captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. Those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute. Something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit.
I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, the barns. They're heading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. Evidently, there's some difficulty with our field transmission. However, we will return to that point at the earliest opportunity. In the meantime, we have a late bulletin from San Diego, California. Professor Indelkofer, speaking at a dinner of the California Astronomical Society, expressed the opinion that the explosions on Mars are undoubtedly nothing more than severe volcanic disturbances on the surface of the planet. We continue now with our piano interlude. Ladies and gentlemen, I've just been handed a message that came in from Grover's Mill by telephone. Just one moment, please. At least 40 people, including 6 state troopers, lie dead in a field east of the village of Grover's Mill. Their bodies burned and distorted beyond all possible recognition. The next voice you hear will be that of Brigadier General Montgomery Smith, commander of the state militia at Trenton, New Jersey.
I have been requested by the governor of New Jersey to place the counties of Mercer and Middlesex as far west as Princeton and east to Jamesburg under martial law. No one will be permitted to enter this area except by special pass issued by state or military authorities. 4 companies of state militia are proceeding from Trenton to Grover's Mill and will aid in the evacuation of homes within the range of military operations. Thank you.
You have just been listening to General Montgomery Smith, commanding the state militia at Trenton. In the meantime, further details of the catastrophe at Grover's Mill are coming in. The strange creatures, after unleashing their deadly assault, crawled back in their pit and made no attempt to prevent the efforts of the firemen to recover the bodies and extinguish the fire. The combined fire departments of Mercer County are fighting the flames which menace the entire countryside. We have been unable to establish any contact with our mobile unit at Grover's Mill, but we hope to be able to return you there at the earliest possible moment. In the meantime, we take you to... Just one moment, please. Ladies and gentlemen, I have just been informed that we have finally established communication with an eyewitness of the tragedy. Professor Pearson has been located at a farmhouse near Grover's Mill, where he has established an emergency observation post. As a scientist, he will give you his explanation of the calamity. The next voice you hear will be that of Professor Pearson, brought to you by direct wire. Professor Pearson.
Of the creatures in the rocket cylinder at Grover's Mill, I can give you no authoritative information, either as to their nature, their origin, or their purposes here on Earth. Of their destructive instrument, I might venture some conjectural explanation. For want of a better term, I shall refer to the mysterious weapon as a heat ray. It's all too evident that these creatures have scientific knowledge far in advance of our own. It's my guess that in some way they are able to generate an intense heat in a chamber of practically absolute non-conductivity. This intense heat they project in a parallel beam against any object they choose by means of a polished parabolic mirror of unknown composition, much as the mirror of a lighthouse projects a beam of light. That is my conjecture of the origin of the heat ray.
Thank you, Professor Pearson. Ladies and gentlemen, here is a bulletin from Trenton. It is a brief statement informing us that the charred body of Carl Phillips has been identified in a Trenton hospital. Now here's another bulletin from Washington, D.C. The office of the director of the National Red Cross reports 10 units of Red Cross emergency workers have been assigned to the headquarters of the state militia, stationed outside of Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Here's a bulletin from State Police, Princeton Junction. The fires at Grover's Mill and vicinity are now under control. Scouts report all quiet in the pit, and there is no sign of life appearing from the mouth of the cylinder. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have a special statement from Mr. Harry McDonald, Vice President in charge of operations.
We have received a request from the state militia of Trenton to place at their disposal our entire broadcasting facilities. view of the gravity of the situation, and believing that radio has a responsibility to serve in the public interest at all times, we are turning over our facilities to the state militia at Trenton. We take you now to the field headquarters of the state militia near Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
This is Captain Lansing of the Signal Corps attached to the state militia, now engaged in military operations in the vicinity of Grover's Mill. Situation arising from the reported presence of certain individuals of unidentified nature is now under complete control. The cylindrical object lies in a pit directly below our position, surrounded on all sides by 8 battalions of infantry, without heavy field pieces, but adequately armed with rifles and machine guns. All cause for alarm, if such cause ever existed, is now entirely unjustified. Things, whatever they are, do not even venture to poke their heads above the pit. I can see their hiding place plainly in the glare of the searchlight here. With all their reported resources, these creatures can scarcely stand up against heavy machine gun fire. Anyway, it's an interesting outing for the troops. I can make out their khaki uniforms crossing back and forth in front of the lights. Looks almost like a real war. There appears to be some slight smoke in the woods bordering the Millstone River. Probably fire started by campers. Well, we ought to see some action soon. One of the companies is deploying on the left flank. A quick thrust and it'll all be over. Now, wait a minute. I see something on top of the cylinder. No, it's nothing but a shadow. Now the troops are on the edge of the Wilmot Farm. 7,000 armed men closing in on an old metal tube. A tub, rather. Well, wait, that wasn't a shadow. It's something moving. Solid metal, kind of a shield-like affair, rising up out of the cylinder. Going higher and higher. What? It's standing on legs, actually rearing up on a sort of metal framework. Now it's reaching above the trees and the searchlights are on it. Hold on.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars. The battle which took place tonight at Grover Mills has ended in one of the most startling defeats ever suffered by an army in modern times. 7,000 men armed with rifles and machine guns pitted against the single fighting machine of the invaders from Mars. 120 known survivors. The rest strewn over the battle area from Grover's Mill to Plainsboro, crushed and trampled to death under the metal feet of the monster, or burned to cinders by its heat ray. The monster is now in control of the middle section of New Jersey and has effectively cut the state through its center. Communication lines are down from Pennsylvania to the Atlantic Ocean. Railroad tracks are torn and service from New York to Philadelphia discontinued except routing some of the trains through Allerton and Phoenixville. Highways to the north, south, and west are clogged with frantic human traffic. Police and army reserves are unable to control the mad flight. By morning, the fugitives will have swelled Philadelphia, Camden, and Trenton, it is estimated, to twice their normal population. Martial law prevails throughout New Jersey and eastern Pennsylvania. At this time, we take you to Washington for a special broadcast on the national emergency. The Secretary of the Interior.
Citizens of the nation, I shall not try to conceal the gravity of the situation that confronts the country, nor the concern of your government in protecting the lives and property of its people. However, I wish to impress upon you, private citizens and public officials, all of you, the urgent need of calm and resourceful action. Fortunately, this formidable enemy is still confined to a comparatively small area, and we may place our faith in the military forces to keep them there. In the meantime, placing our faith in God, we must continue the performance of our duties, each and every one of us, so that we may confront this destructive adversary with a nation united, courageous, and consecrated to the preservation of human supremacy on this earth. I thank you.
You have just heard the Secretary of the Interior speaking from Washington. Bulletins too numerous to read are piling up in the studio here. We're informed that the central portion of New Jersey is blacked out from radio communication due to the effect of the heat ray upon power lines and electrical equipment.
Here is a special bulletin in New York. Cables have been received from English, French, and German scientific bodies offering assistance. Astronomers report continued gas outbursts at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The majority voiced the opinion that the enemy will be reinforced by additional rocket machines. There have been several attempts made to locate Professor Pearson of Princeton, who has observed Martians at close range. It is feared he was lost in the recent battle. Langham Field, Virginia. Scouting planes report three Martian machines visible above treetops, moving north toward Somerville with population fleeing ahead of them. The heat ray is not in use, although advancing at express train speed, invaders pick their way carefully. They seem to be making a conscious effort to avoid destruction of cities and countryside. However, they stop to uproot power lines, bridges, and railroad tracks. Their apparent objective is to crush resistance, paralyze communication, and disorganize human society. Here is a bulletin from Basking Ridge, New Jersey. Coon hunters have stumbled on a second cylinder similar to the first, embedded in the Great Swamp 20 miles south of Morristown. Army field pieces are proceeding from Newark to blow up the second invading unit before the cylinder can be opened from the fighting machine rig. They are taking up a position in the foothills of Watchung Mountain. Another bulletin from Langham Field, Virginia. Scouting planes report enemy machines, now three in number, increasing speed northward, kicking over houses and trees in their evident haste to form a conjunction with their allies south of Morristown. Machines also sighted by telephone operator east of Middlesex, within 10 miles of Plainfield. Here's a bulletin from Winston-Salem, Long Island. A fleet of army bombers carrying heavy explosives flying north in pursuit of enemy. Scouting planes act as guides. They keep the speeding enemy in sight. Just a moment, please, ladies and gentlemen. We've run special wires to the artillery line and adjacent villages to give you direct reports in the zone of the advancing enemy. First, we take you to the battery of the 22nd Field Artillery, located in the Watchung Mountains.
Range 32 meters.
32 meters.
Direction 39 degrees.
39 degrees.
Fire!
40 yards to the right, sir.
Drift range, 31 meters.
31 meters.
Projection, 37 degrees.
37 degrees.
Fire.
Hit, sir. Got the tripod of one of them. They're stopped. The others are trying to repair it.
Quick, get the range. Shift 50, 30 meters.
30 meters.
Projection, 27 degrees.
27 degrees.
Fire.
Don't see the cell answer. Letting off a smoke.
What is it?
Black smoke, sir. Moving this way. Trying to go to the ground. Moving fast.
Put on gas mask. Ready to fire. Lift to 24 meters.
24 meters.
Projection 24 degrees.
24 degrees.
Fire.
You can't see, sir. No coming near.
Get the range.
33 meters.
23 meters.
23 meters. 22.
22.
Please.
Army bombing plane V-843 off Bayonne, New Jersey. Lieutenant Bolt, commanding 8 bombers, reporting to Commander Fairfax, Langham Field. This is Bolt reporting to Commander Fairfax, Langham Field. Enemy tripod machines now in sight. Reinforced by 3 machines from the Morristown cylinder. 6 altogether. 1 machine partially crippled. Believed hit by shell from army gun in Watchung Mountains. Guns now appear silent. A heavy black fog hanging close to the earth of extreme density, nature unknown. No sign of heat ray. Enemy now turns east, crossing Passaic River into the Jersey marshes. Another straddles the Pulaski Skyway. Evident objective is New York City. They're pushing down a high-tension power station. Machines are close together now, and we're ready to attack. Planes circling, ready to strike. 1,000 yards, and we'll be over the first. 800 yards. Six hundred. 400. 200. There they go. Tired arm raised. Green flash. They're spraying us with flame. 2,000 feet. Engines are giving out. No chance to release bombs. Only one thing left. Stop on them. Plane and all. We're diving on the first one. Now the engine's gone.
This is Bayonne, New Jersey, calling Langham Field. This is Bayonne, New Jersey, calling Langham Field. Come in, please.
Langham Field. Go ahead.
8 Army bombers in engagement with enemy tripod machines over Jersey Flats. Engines incapacitated by heat ray. All crashed. 1 enemy machine destroyed. Enemy now discharging heavy black smoke in direction of...
Newark, New Jersey. Newark, New Jersey. Warning. Poisonous black smoke pouring in from Jersey marshes. Streets of South Street. Gas mask useless. Urge population to move into open spaces. Automobiles use routes 7, 23, 24. Avoid congested areas. Smoke now spreading over Raymond Boulevard.
Two extra well calling CQ, two extra well calling CQ, two extra well calling 8X3R, come in please.
With 8X3R coming back at 2X2L.
Odds reception. Odds reception. K please. Where are you, 8X3R? What's the matter? Where are you?
I'm speaking from the roof of Broadcasting Building. I'm speaking from the roof of Broadcasting Building, New York City. The bells you hear are ringing to warn the people to evacuate the city as Martians approach. Estimated in the last 2 hours, 3 million people have moved out along the roads to the north. Hutchinson River Parkway is still kept open for motor traffic. Void bridges to Long Island, hopelessly jammed. All communication with Jersey Shore closed 10 minutes ago. No more defenses. Our army is wiped out. Artillery, Air Force, everything wiped out. It may be the last broadcast. We'll stay here to the end. People are holding service here below us in the cathedral. Now I look down the harbor, all manner of boats, overloaded with fleeing population, pulling out from docks. Streets are all jammed, noise and crowds like New Year's Eve in city. Wait a minute, the enemy is now in sight above the Palisades, Five great machines. The first one is crossing the river. I can see it from here, wading the Hudson like a man wading through a brook. A bulletin is handed me. Martian cylinders are falling all over the country. One outside of Buffalo, one in Chicago, St. Louis. Seem to be timed and spaced. Now the first machine reaches the shore. He stands watching, looking over the city. Steel cowlish head is even with the skyscrapers. He waits for the others. They rise like a line of new towers on the city's west side. Now they're lifting their metal hands. This is the end now. Smoke comes out, black smoke. Drifting over the city. People in the streets see it now. They're running toward the East River, thousands of them.
dropping in like rats. Now the smoke's spreading faster. It's reached Times Square. People are trying to run away from it, but it's no use. They're falling like flies. Now the smoke's crossing 6th Avenue. 5th Avenue. 100 yards away. It's just defeat.
Calling CQ. 2X2L calling CQ. 2X2L calling CQ, New York. Is there anyone on the air? Is there anyone on the air? Is there anyone? 2X2L.
You are listening to a CBS presentation of Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the Air in an original dramatization of The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. The performance will continue after a brief intermission. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System. The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, starring Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the Air.
I set down these notes on paper. I'm obsessed by the thought that I may be the last living man on Earth. I've been hiding in this empty house near Grover's Mill, a small island of daylight cut off by the black smoke from the rest of the world. All that happened before the arrival of these monstrous creatures in the world now seems part of another life. A life that has no continuity with the present. Furtive existence, the lonely derelict who pencils these words on the back of some astronomical notes bearing the signature of Richard Pearson. Look down at my blackened hand. Try to connect them with a professor who lives at Princeton and who on the night of October 20th glimpsed through his telescope an orange splash of light on a distant planet. My wife, my colleagues, my students, my books, my observatory, my world. Where are they? Did they ever exist? Am I Richard Pearson? What day is it? Do days exist without calendars? Does time pass when there are no human hands left to wind the clocks? Writing down my daily life, I tell myself I shall preserve human history between the dark covers of this little book that was meant to record the movements of the stars. But to write, I must live, and to live, I must eat. Find moldy bread in the kitchen and an orange not too spoiled to swallow. Keep watch at the window. Time to time, I catch sight of a Martian above the black smoke. Smoke still holds the house in its black coil, but thanks, there's a hissing sound, and suddenly I see a Martian mounted on his machine, spraying the air with a jet of steam as if to dissipate the smoke. I watch in a corner as his huge metal legs nearly brush against the house. Exhausted by terror, I fall asleep. Morning. Sun streams in the window. Black cloud of gas is lifted, and the scorched meadows to the north look as though a black snowstorm had passed over. I venture from the house. I make my way to a road, no traffic. In a wrecked car, baggage overturned, a blackened skeleton. Push on north. For some reason I feel safer trailing these monsters than running away from them. And I keep a careful watch. I've seen the Martians feed. If one of their machines appear over the top of trees, I'm ready to fling myself flat on the earth. Come to a chestnut tree. Chestnut to right. Fill my pockets. Keep a line. 2 days I wander in a vague, motherly direction through a desolate world. Finally, I notice a living creature. A small red squirrel in a beech tree. I stare at him and wonder. He stares back at me. I believe at that moment the animal and I shared the same emotion. Joy of finding another living being. Push on north. I find dead cows in a brackish field and beyond the charred ruins of a dairy in a silo. Ain't standing guard over the wasteland like a lighthouse. Deserted by the sea. Stride the silo, perches a weathercock. The arrow points north. North. Next day, I come to a city. City vaguely familiar in its contours, yet its buildings strangely dwarfed and leveled off as if a giant had sliced off its highest towers with a capricious sweep of his hand. Reached the outskirts, I found Newark. Newark, undemolished but humbled by some whim of the advancing Martians. Presently, with an odd feeling of being watched, I caught sight of something crouching in a doorway. I made a step towards it. Rose up and became a man. Man armed with a large knife.
Stop!
I come from... from many places. A long time ago, from Princeton.
Princeton? Near Grover's Mill.
Yes.
Grover's Mill. There's no food here. This is my country. All this end of town down the river. There's only food for one. Which way are you going?
I don't know. I guess I'm looking for people.
And what was that? You hear something just then?
No. Only a bird. A live bird.
Get to know that birds have shadows these days. Hey, we're in the open here. Let's crawl in this doorway here and talk.
Have you seen any Martians?
No. They're going over to New York. Night, the sky's alive with their lights, just as if people were still living in it. The daylight, you can't see them. 5 days ago, a couple of them carried something big across the flats from the airport. I think they're learning how to fly.
Fly?
Yeah, fly.
Then it's all over with humanity. Stranger, there's still you and I. Two of us left.
They got themselves in solid. They wrecked the greatest country in the world. Those green stars, they're probably falling somewhere every night. They've only lost one machine. There isn't anything to do. We're done. We're licked.
Where were you? You're in a uniform.
Yeah, what's left of it. I was in the militia. National Guard. That's good. There wasn't any war. Any more than there's war between men and ants.
Yes, but we're eatable ants. I found that out. What'll they do to us?
I filled it all out. Right now, we're caught as we're wanted. The Martian only has to go a few miles to get a crowd on the run. But they won't keep on doing that. They'll begin catching us systematic, like keeping the best and storing us in cages and things. They haven't begun on us yet.
Not begun?
Not begun. All that's happened so far is because we don't have sense enough to keep quiet. Bothering them with guns and such stuff and losing our heads and rushing off in crowds. Instead of our rushing around blind, we gotta fix ourselves up. Fix ourselves up according to the way things are now. Cities, nations, civilization, progress.
Yes, but if that's so, What is there to live for?
Well, there won't be any more concerts for a million years or so, and no nice little dinners at restaurants. If it's amusement you're after, I guess the game's up.
What is there left?
Life, that's what. I want to live. Yeah, and so do you. We're not going to be exterminated. And I don't mean to be caught either. Tamed and fattened and bred like an ox.
What are you going to do?
I'm going on. Right under their feet. I got a plan. We men as men are finished. We don't know enough. We got to learn plenty before we got a chance. We've got to live and keep free what we learn, see? I've thought it all out, see?
Well, tell me the rest.
Well, it isn't all of us that are made for wild beasts. That's what it got to be. That's what it got to be. That's why I watched you. Watched you. All those little office workers that used to live in these houses, they'd be no good. They haven't any stuff in them. Run. Run off to work. I've seen hundreds of them running to catch their commuter's train in the morning, afraid they'd get canned if they didn't. Running back at night, afraid they wouldn't be in time for dinner. Lives insured and a little invested in case of accidents. And on Sundays, worried about the hereafter. The Martians, they'll be a godsend for those guys. Nice roomy cages. Good food, careful breeding, no worries. Yeah, after a week or so of chasing around the fields on empty stomachs, they'll come and be glad to be caught.
You've thought it all out, haven't you?
Sure, you bet I have. That isn't all. These Martians are going to make pets of them. Train them to do tricks. Who knows, get sentimental over the pet boy who grew up and had to be killed. Yeah, some maybe. They'll train to hunt us.
Oh, no.
Yes, they will. There's men who do it gladly. Me, why?
Meantime, you and I and others like us, where are we to live when the Martians own the Earth?
I got it all figured out. We live underground. I've been thinking about the sewers. Under New York, there are miles and miles of them. The main ones, they're big enough for anybody. And there's cellars, vaults. Underground storerooms, railway tunnels, subways. Begin to see that. We got a bunch of strong men together. No weaklings. That rubbish. Out.
As you meant me to go.
Give you a chance, didn't I?
Won't quarrel about that. Go on.
Well, you gotta make safe places for us to stay in, see? Get all the books we can. Science books. That's where men like you come in, see? We raid the museums. We'll even spy on the Martians. May not be so much we have to learn before... Just imagine this. Four or five of their own fighting machines suddenly start off. Heat rays right and left. Not a Martian in them. Not a Martian in them, see? But men. Men who've learned the way how. May even be in our time. Gee. Imagine having one of them lovely things with its heat ray wide and free. We'd turn it on Martians. We'd turn it on men. We'd bring everybody down on their knees.
That's your plan.
Yeah. You. Me. Martians. We'd own the world.
I see.
Hey. What's going?
Not to your world. Bye, stranger. Well, after parting with the artilleryman, I came at last to the Holland Tunnel, entered that silent tube, anxious to know the fate of the great city on the other side of the Hudson. Cautiously, I came out of the tunnel and made my way up Canal Street. Reached 14th Street, and there again were black powder and several bodies and an evil, ominous smell from the gratings of the cellars of some of the houses. I wandered up through the 30s and 40s, stood alone on Times Square, caught sight of a lean dog running down 7th Avenue with a piece of dark brown meat in his jaws, a pack of starving mongrels at his heel, made a wide circle around me as though he feared I might prove a fresh competitor, walked up Broadway in the direction of that strange powder, that silent shop windows, displaying their mute wares to empty sidewalks, past the Capitol Theater, silent, dark, Just a shooting gallery where a row of empty guns faced an arrested line of wooden ducks near Columbus Circle. I noticed models of 1939 motor cars in the showrooms facing empty streets. Over the top of the General Motors building, I watched a flock of black birds circling in the sky. Right on. Suddenly, I caught sight of the hood of a Martian machine, standing somewhere in Central Park, gleaming in the late afternoon sun. Insane idea. I rushed recklessly across Columbus Circle and into the park. I climbed a small hill above the pond at 60th Street, and from there I could see, standing in a silent row along the mall, 19 of those great metal titans, their cowls empty, their steel arms hanging listlessly by their sides. I looked in vain for the monsters that inhabit those machines. Suddenly my eyes were attracted to the immense flock of black birds that hovered directly below me. They circled to the ground. And there before my eyes, stark and silent, lay the Martians with the hungry birds pecking and tearing brown shreds of flesh from their dead bodies. Later, when their bodies were examined in laboratories, it was found that they were killed by the putrefactive and diseased bacteria against which their systems were unprepared. Plain, after all, man's defenses have failed. They're the humblest thing that God, His wisdom, has put upon this earth. Before the cylinder fell, there was a general persuasion that through all the deep of space, no life existed beyond the petty surface of our minute sphere. Now we see further. Dim and wonderful is the vision I've conjured up in my mind of life spreading slowly from this little seedbed of the solar system throughout the inanimate vastnesses of sidereal space. But remote dream, maybe. Maybe that the destruction of the Martians is only a reprieve to them and not to us. The future ordained, perhaps. How strange it now seems to sit in my peaceful study at Princeton, writing down this last chapter of the record, begun at a deserted farm in Grover's Mill. Strange to watch children playing in the streets. Strange to see young people strolling on the green where the new spring grass heals the last black scars of a blue dirt. Strange to watch the sightseers enter the museum where the dissembled parts of a Martian machine are kept on public view. Strange when I recall the time when I first saw it. Bright and clean cut, hard and silent under the dawn of that last great day. This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, out of character to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo. Starting now, we couldn't soap all your windows and steal all your garden gates. By tomorrow night, though, we did the best next thing. We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it, and that both institutions are still open for business. So goodbye, everybody, and remember, please, for the next day or so, the terrible lesson you learned tonight. That grinning, glowing, globular invader of your living room is an inhabitant of the pumpkin patch, and if your doorbell rings and nobody's there, that was no Martian. It's Halloween.
Tonight, the Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations coast to coast has brought you The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, the 17th in its weekly series of dramatic broadcasts featuring Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air. Next week, we present a dramatization of three famous short stories. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System. Thank you.
The first great fright film of the talking era was, of course, Dracula. Three sinister syllables forever synonymous with Bela Lugosi. He played the role a thousand times or more on the legitimate stage before transferring it to the screen. And his fame spread from Transylvania, where he was born, to become a household word. Count Dracula, Bela Lugosi, one and the same. A suave, sinister, supernatural figure. His unique voice somehow suited the peculiar intonations and inflections of a prince of darkness, undead 500 years. Hear that magnetic voice again now, as Bela Lugosi speaks to you from the past and introduces himself.
I am Dracula. I bid you welcome. Listen to them. Children of the night. What music they make. The spider spinning his web for the unwary fly. The blood is the light, Mr. Renfield. I trust you have kept your coming here a secret.
I followed your instructions implicitly.
Excellent, Mr. Renfield. Excellent. I have chartered a ship. Take us to England. We will be leaving tomorrow evening. I hope you will find this comfortable.
Thanks. It looks very inviting.
This is very old wine. I hope you will like it.
Aren't you drinking?
I never drink. Why?
It's delicious.
And now I'll leave you. Good night, Mr. Renfield.
Evening. I hope you're not frightened. I'm your old friend, Bela Lugosi, better known as the fiendish vampire, Count Dracula. If I have frightened you in this character, it is because I portrayed it just as I learned about it at my birthplace in Transylvania. And as the legend goes, if you believe in it, don't think that you are safe from vampires. Oh, no. Supernatural beings are not chained to their graves. They are free to roam the entire world, and even to seek their victims right here. The vampire feeds by night on the blood of the living. The daybreak goes back to its coffin, which is filled with the earth of his native soil. There awaits the nightfall when it can go forth to prowl the land. Once it has chosen you as its victim, you will be pursued relentlessly until it has fastened its teeth in your throat and have drained your veins of all your blood. But there is a way to destroy a vampire. All you have to do is to drag it by day to its lair and catch it as it lies sleeping in the coffin. Then drive a stake through its heart. Very simple, isn't it? So when you lie abed tonight in your darkened room, and these thoughts give you nightmares, and you dread to look behind the curtains for fear of seeing my horrible face appear at the window, just pull yourself together and remember that after all, there are such things.
The Mercury Theater on the Air presents Orson Welles as Count Dracula,
in his own version of Bram Stoker's great novel, Dracula.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Arthur Seward. I'm here tonight to bear witness to the truth of certain events which you may find it hard to believe, but I ask you to believe them. I have here certain documents, telegrams, clippings from the press of the day, memoranda, and letters in various hands. All needless matters have been eliminated, so that a history almost at variance with the possibilities of contemporary belief may stand forth as simple fact. I present you first with excerpts from the private journal of Jonathan Harker.
I, Jonathan Harker, lawyer's clerk, article to Peter Hawkins, Esquire of Exeter, England, am writing this journal in the hope that if misfortune overtakes me, it may one day come to the eyes of those who love me. I set out from London on the last day of April to visit one of our clients in Eastern Europe. On May the 3rd, I arrived in Budapest and came after nightfall to Klausenburg on the borders of Transylvania. At Bistritz, there was a letter of welcome for me from our client, informing me that his carriage would await me at the Borgo Pass. It was signed Dracula.
Bukovina! Couch for Bukovina!
The road was rough, but still we seemed to fly over it with feverish haste. When it grew dark, there seemed to be some excitement among the passengers. They kept speaking to the driver and looking at me and urging him on to greater speed. The crazy coach rocked on its great leather string. The mountains seemed to come nearer to us on either side.
Coachman! Coachman!
What is it? Where are we?
You're nearing your destination, young hare. This is the Borgo Pass.
There were black, rolling clouds overhead, and in the air, the heavy, oppressive sense of thunder. Now, we were through the pass.
The young hare is not expected after all.
You are early tonight, my friend.
A caleche with four horses had drawn up beside us.
Let me help you, sir.
The coachman smiled, and the lamplight fell on a hard-looking mouth with very red lips and sharp-looking teeth as white as ivory. We began to move. I looked back. The coach and its load of passengers had vanished from sight. We swept into the darkness of the pass. I struck a match. It was within a few minutes of midnight. And then a dog began to howl somewhere far down the road. The wind was rising, moaned and whistled through the rocks, and the branches of the trees flashed together as we swept along. It grew colder and colder still, and fine powdery snow began to fall. The baying of wolves sounded nearer and nearer, as though they were closing round us on every side. We kept on ascending, always ascending. The howling of wolves was growing less. Presently, it ceased altogether. And just then, the moon broke through the black clouds, and by its light, I saw round us a ring of wolves running alongside the carriage, in silence, with white teeth and lolling red tongues, with long sinuated limbs and shaggy hair.
Welcome to my house.
I must have fallen asleep. The carriage had pulled up in the courtyard of a vast ruined castle. The coachman was nowhere to be seen.
Welcome to my house. Come freely, go safely, and leave something of the happiness you bring.
Count Dracula?
I am Dracula.
His face was strong, very strong, aquiline. The mouth, so far as I could see under the heavy mustache, was fixed and rather cruel looking, with peculiarly sharp white teeth.
You hear me, Mr. Harker?
The wolf?
The children of the night, as you say, Mr. Harker. The wolves. Listen. Come now. There are many things you must tell me tomorrow. Of England and of the estate there you have purchased for me.
Yes.
The estate is called Carfax, I believe.
Yes, that is so.
But now I will detain you no longer. You will find your room in readiness. And I advise you not to leave it during the night.
This castle is on the very edge of a terrible precipice. A stone falling from the window would fall 1,000 feet without touching anything. I explored. There are doors, doors, doors everywhere, and all of them locked. The door to the great hall, the door to the courtyard, every door in the castle is closed, bolted against me. The castle of Dracula is a prison, and I am a prisoner. The next night, I couldn't sleep. So after a few hours, I got up and, lighting my candle, I placed my shaving mirror on the dressing table and was just beginning to shave.
You seem restless, Mr. Harker.
I hadn't seen him, although the reflection of the glass covered the whole room behind me. I turned to the glass again. Count Dracula was close to me, and I could see him over my shoulder, but there was no reflection of him in the mirror. It was blank. I started and cut myself on the side of the throat. The blood was trickling down my neck. Count, my mirror!
The blood. Wipe the blood from your face, Mr. Harker. And take care how you cut yourself. It is more dangerous than you think in this country.
When I awoke, I found most of my things were gone. My passport, my notes, my letter of credit. I could find no trace of them anywhere. And my door is locked from the outside. June 20th. There is work of some kind going on in the castle. Now and then I hear the faraway muffled sound of mattock and spade. And last night, the second of the predated letters which Dracula made me write, the second of that series which is to blot out the very traces of my existence from the earth, went forth. Count Dracula.
Yes, my young friend.
Well, what of me? When am I free? When can I leave this place?
Free? Mr. Harker, you're always free. You want to leave? Would you like to leave tonight?
Yes, yes, in God's name.
My dear young friend, not an hour shall you wait in my house against your will. Come, follow me. The door seems to be bolted. How strange. The door is locked.
Well, in God's name, open it.
As you will, Mr. Harker. You English have a proverb which is very close to my heart. Welcome the coming, speed the parting guest. Good night, Mr. Harker.
Shut the door! Shut the door! I tell you, shut the door!
The door is shut, Mr. Harker. I take it you will remain.
Morning, June the 30th. These may be the last words I ever write in this diary. Oh, God preserve my sanity. I have never seen Count Dracula by day. At sunrise, at the first cock crow, he is gone. I do not understand these things. I only know that the wolves obey him, and that he is a man with hair on the palm of his hands, with sharp teeth, and no blood in his face. He casts no shadow. He cannot be seen in a glass. And he moves like a bat across the sheer face of the castle walls. He eats no food and is mortally afraid of the crucifix. As I write this, I hear in the courtyard the rolling of heavy wheels and the cracking of whips. And there is in the passageway below a sound of heavy boxes being set down. Boxes shaped like coffins. And I know what they hold. Boxes are filled with holy earth from the chapel beneath the castle. It's the last box being nailed down. And now I hear the heavy feet tramping again. The door shut. The chains rattle. In the courtyard and down the rocky way, the roll of heavy wheels, the crack of whips. The wagons have gone. I'm alone in the castle. I'm alone in the castle. I'm alone in the castle. I'm alone. I'm alone. I'm alone.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Dr. Seward. Mr. Harker's journal terminates at this point. I now present in evidence a clipping dated August 8th of that year from the Yorkshire Telegraph from our correspondent in Whitby. One of the greatest and suddenest storms on record was experienced here today. The weather has been somewhat sultry, but Saturday evening was fine. The band was playing. The piers were crowded with holidaymakers. The wind fell away entirely during the evening, and there was a dead calm. There were but few lights at sea. The only sail noticeable was a foreign schooner under full canvas, which was seemingly going westward. A little after midnight came a strange sound from over the sea, and high overhead the air began to carry a strange, faint, hollow booming. Then, without warning, the tempest broke. And there, with all sails set, was the foreign schooner rushing with terrific speed toward the shore. A searchlight was turned on her. And there, lashed to the helm, was a corpse, with drooping head which swayed horribly to and fro at each motion of the ship. A moment later, she crashed. And then a strange thing was seen. At the very instant she touched, a huge dog sprang up on deck from below and, running forward, jumped from the bow onto the sand and, making straight up the east cliff toward the graveyard, vanished into the night. The Coast Guard, going aboard at dawn, found the dead man fastened to a spoke of the wheel. Tightly clutched in one hand was a crucifix. The man must have been dead for quite 2 days. In the pocket of the dead man's coat was found a bottle, carefully corked, containing a roll of paper. This proved to be an addendum to the ship's log. There was found on board only a small amount of cargo, and that of a most unusual nature. Apparently the ship carried nothing but earth. Common earth. Packed away in wooden boxes, shaped much like coffins.
Log of the Demeter. Russian flag, Black Sea, to Whitby. July 6th. Finished taking in cargo, a queer cargo, boxes of earth. At noon, set sail, east wind, fresh. Crew, four hands, two mates, cook, and myself, captain. July 11th. Entered Bosporus. At dark, passed through Dardanelle. Mate reported in morning that one of crew, Valjodin, was missing.
Took larboard watch, 8 bells last night. She was relieved by Chilegian, who came to his bunk.
Something aboard the ship.
No. Don't laugh, Captain. In the rain last night, a tall, thin man go up companionway and along the deck forward and disappeared. When I go to the bow, no one. And the hatchways all closed.
July 22nd. Rough weather last 3 days. All hands busy with sails. No time be frightened. Past Gibraltar and out through Strait. All well. July 24th. Last night, another hand was lost. Disappeared.
By Galicia. Leave off watch midnight. Then we never see him again.
What's double watch now?
Don't take watch alone no more.
Double watch.
July 29th. Had single watch tonight as crew too tired to double. When morning comes...
Harry! Hey, Milo! Barrington! Is Barrington, Milo?
Barrington's gone! Oh, Barrington's gone like the others!
Like all the others.
The mate and I have agreed to go armed henceforth, July 30th. Last night, we are nearing England. Weather fine. All sail set.
Captain! Captain! The men are watching the sails and missing! Most missing!
Now, only self and mate and one hand left to work ship. August 3rd. 2 days of fog and not a sail sighted. At midnight, I went to relieve the man at wheel, and when I got to it, found no one there.
It's here! I know it now. I saw it. Like a man, tall and thin and ghastly pale. It was in the bows looking out. I gave it the knife and my knife went through it.
What?
Empty as air.
What is it? What are you talking about?
It's here and I'll find it.
in the hold. In one of those boxes of earth. I'll unscrew them one by one and see. And see.
He is mad. Stark raving mad. It's no use my trying to stop him. He can't hurt those big boxes. They are invoiced as common earth.
He's there. Down in the cold. I know the secret now. The sea will save me from him. That's all that's left. That's all that's left.
August 4th. I am all alone on my ship. And still the fog. I dared not go below. I dared not leave the helm. So here all night I stayed. And in the dimness of the night, I saw it. I saw him. God forgive me, but the mate was right to jump overboard. It was better to die like a sailor in the blue water. But I am captain, and I must not leave my ship. I shall tie my hands to the wheel when my strength begins to fail, and along with them I shall tie that which it dare not touch, my crucifix. I am growing weaker. And the night is coming on. God and the Blessed Virgin help a poor ignorant soul trying to do his duty.
Telegram, Seward, Pursuit, to Van Helsing, Amsterdam. Lucy West Penrod in alarming condition. Cannot diagnose. Come at once. Seward.
Telegram, Van Helsing, Amsterdam, to Seward, Percy. I'm on my way to you. Please arrange the examination patient immediately my arrival, Van Helsing.
Ladies and gentlemen, I must now explain that 6 months before the events recorded here, I had become engaged to a young lady, Lucy Westenra. We were to have been married in the spring. My old teacher, Professor Van Helsing, arrived at 4 the next afternoon. I took him at once to Lucy's house. She lay in a bed asleep. She was ghastly, chalkily pale. The red seemed to have gone even from her lips and gums. And the bones of her face stood out.
Young miss is bad. Very bad. She must have blood or she will die. Yet she is not anemic. The qualitative analysis of her blood gives quite normal condition. It is strange. I do not like to think how strange. Look! My God, her throat, look!
The black velvet band that she always wore had dragged up a little and showed a red mark on her throat. Just over the external jugular vein were two punctures, not large, but not wholesome looking. The edges were white and worn looking. Well? Well, what is it, Professor? What's wrong with her? Speak frankly, you can tell me the worst.
I wish I could, Seward. I wish I could. But I do not dare.
Won't you tell me anything?
I will tell you this. Your young lady is in a danger greater than death. You must believe me. If you leave her for one moment and harm befalls, you will not sleep easy thereafter.
September 8th. I sat up all night with Lucy.
Arthur, I'm afraid.
My dear, you can sleep tonight. I'm here watching you. Nothing can happen. And I promise if any sign of bad dreams, if I see anything, I'll wake you at once.
You will? Will you really? Then I'll sleep.
I sat all night by her bedside. And she did not wake once during the night, although a bows or a bat or something flapped almost angrily against the window panes. September 11th. Still quoting from my private journals. It was this time that I received a message from Purfleet.
Read 10:20 p.m. St. John's Hospital. Serious complications. Case 891. Your immediate presence, London. Imperative. I had no choice. Sometime later, a paper was found among Lucy Westenra's belongings.
I write this and leave it to be seen so that no one may by any chance get into trouble through me. I went to bed as usual, taking care that the window was closed, as Dr. Van Helsing had directed. About 2 a.m, I awakened. I went to the door, called out, Arthur! Arthur! There was no answer. Something's broken the window. I'm in a room, alone. I dare not go out. The house seems empty. The air is full of specks, floating, circling in the draft from the window. And the light burns blue, dim. What am I to do? Something very sweet and very bitter all around me. Nothing sinking into deep water, and there's singing in my ears.
You shall be flesh of my flesh, blood of my blood.
September 12th. Late. Only resolution and habit can let me make an entry tonight. We found her sprawled on the floor. There was a draft in the room from the broken window. Her throat was bare, showing the two wounds, looking horribly white and mangled.
We are too late, my friend. We have failed. God's will be done.
She's dying.
Yes. She's dying. Stay beside her. It will make much difference, mark me. Whether she dies conscious or in her sleep.
It was late in the afternoon before she opened her eyes.
Arthur, oh, my love, I'm so glad you've come.
I took her hand and knelt beside her. Her breath came and went like a tired, peaceful child. And then the light from the setting sun fell on her face, and then, insensibly, a strange change came over her. Her eyes grew suddenly dull and hard. Her breathing was heavy. The mouth opened and the pale gums drawn back made the teeth look large and sharp.
Arthur, oh, my love, I'm so glad you've come. Kiss me. Bend down and kiss me.
Not for your life. Not for your living soul and health. Lucy!
She's dead.
Poor girl. There's peace for her at last. The end.
Not so. It is only the beginning. Wait and see.
Extra special,
the Westminster Gazette, September 25th. A Hempstead mystery. The Kensington horror, the stabbing woman, and the woman in black are vividly recalled to mind by a series of events that have taken place recently in the neighborhood of Hempstead. Several cases have occurred of young children straying from home or failing to return from their playing on the heath. In all these cases, the children have given as their excuse that they have been with a beautiful lady who offered them chocolate. In each case, the child was found to be slightly torn or wounded in the throat. The wound seems such as might be made by a rat or a small dog.
The Hempstead horror. Another child injured by the beautiful lady. He has just received intelligence that another child missed last night was only discovered late in the morning. It has the same tiny wound in throat.
Well, Stuart, what do you think of that? Do you mean to tell me, my friend, that you still have no suspicion as to what poor Lucy died of?
Nervous prostration, following Great loss and waste of blood.
And how was the blood lost or wasted? You are a clever man, my friend, and a good doctor. But you do not believe that there are things that you cannot understand. You are wrong, Stuart. Are you aware of all the mysteries of life and death? Can you tell me why in the pampas there are bats that come at night and open the veins of cattle and horses and suck dry those veins? How in some islands of the western seas there are bats which hang on trees all day and then when the sailors sleep on deck because it is hot, flit down on them and then in the morning are found dead men as white as Miss Lucy was?
I understand none of these things.
After tonight, Seward, if you dare to come with me, perhaps then you will understand.
September 29th. Before dawn, Howard is done. And I would sooner die a thousand deaths than live again through what I did this night.
We will spend the night, you and I, here in this churchyard where Miss Lucy is buried. We enter the tomb.
Then?
We open the coffin. You shall yet be convinced.
Take care, Van Helsing.
Miss Lucy is dead, is it not so? Then there can be no wrong to her, but if she is not dead...
With some difficulty, we found the West Enra tomb. I took up my place behind a yew tree. On one side of the tomb, Van Helsing on the other. Chilled and frightened. Suddenly, I saw something moving between two yew trees, a dim white figure which held something at its breast. The figure stopped. I could not see the face, for it was bent down over what I saw to be a fair-haired child. There was a sharp little cry, such as a child gives in sleep, or a dog as it lies before the fire. And dreams. Then the thing saw us. She drew back with an angry snarl. The lovely blood-stained mouth grew to an open square. If ever a face meant death, I saw it at that moment. Then suddenly she turned and vanished in the direction of the tomb.
Child is not harmed. We leave him in a safe place where the police find him. There's more to do. Come!
Now we were in the tomb. Then in the coffin. The thing lay. Like a nightmare of Lucy, the pointed teeth, a blood-stained mouth. Van Helsing never looked up. From his bag, he took out a book, his operating knives, a heavy hammer, and a round wooden stake, some 2 or 3 inches thick, sharpened to a fine point, and hardened over a fire.
Stuart! The life of this unhappy woman is just begun. When she becomes what you call undead, there comes with the change the curse of immortality. She cannot die, but must go on age after age, adding new victims, because all that die from the preying of the undead become themselves undead and prey on others. So the circle goes on, ever widening as the ripples from a stone thrown in the water. But if this lady, this undead, be made to rest as true dead, then the soul of the poor lady whom we love shall be again free.
Tell me, what am I to do?
Take this stake in your left hand, the hammer in your right.
Yes.
Place the point over the heart.
Yes.
Then, when I begin the prayer for the dead, in God's name, strike. Are you ready? Now, Domine Jesu Christe, Fili de Vivi, Cum manus tuas ex voluntate patri.
On the morning of July 11th, a man was found on the border of Transylvania. He talked wildly of wolves and boxes of earth and blood, and gave his name as Jonathan Harker. In the hospital of Klausenburg, he improved sufficiently to make possible his removal to England. I'm still quoting from my own personal papers. But though his condition remained so serious that he was committed for observation to a private ward in my hospital at Purseed. Here he did so well that in 3 weeks he was completely recovered. It was during this time that his wife, Minna Harker,
brought to the attention of Dr. Van Helsing and myself the journal that her husband had kept while a prisoner in the castle of a certain Count Dracula in Transylvania. I have before me the record of a meeting that took place in my study in Purfleet, transcribed by Mina Harker.
October 1st. Meeting began soon after 8. Jonathan next to me. Dr. Seward opposite to Van Helsing at the head of the table.
My friend, there are such things as vampires. Had I known at first what now I know, one so precious life had been spared to many of us who love her. The vampire which is amongst us is of himself so strong that he can direct all the elements. The storm, the flood, the thunder. He can command all the meaner things. The moth and bat, the owl and the fox and the wolf. How then are we to begin our strike to destroy him? How shall we find his place? And having found it, how can we destroy? My friends, it is a terrible task that we undertake. To fail here is not mere life or death. If we fail, we become as him. Foul things of the night, as him. What do you say?
I answer for myself.
Come, Ian.
I'm with you.
The professor laid a small golden crucifix on the table. We took hands and our solemn pact was made.
My friends, we too are not without strength. The vampire flourishes on the blood of the living. Without this, he cannot live. He throws no shadow. He makes no reflection in a mirror. He can transform himself to a wolf, to a bat. He can come on moonlight rays as elemental dust. He can see in the dark. He can do all these things. Yet he is not free. His power ceases at the coming of the day. Then, until night, he must remain in the shape in which he finds himself, and except in his coffin home, in those earth boxes he cannot rest. When we can confine him in his coffin, then, my friends, if we obey what we know, we will destroy him.
At that moment, something flapped wildly against the window, then...
Did you hit it?
I don't know.
We looked out of the window. Against the black sky, we could see nothing.
Data on our position. From the Count's castle in Transylvania to Whitby came 50 boxes of earth. All of these, to our certain knowledge, were delivered at Carfax. Recently, 12 of these boxes have been removed. First step. Ascertain whether all the rest remain in the deserted house next door or whether any more have been removed. We must trace each of these boxes and sterilize the earth with holy water so that he can no longer seek safety in it. And we must hurry.
The events of the next few days are described in Jonathan Harker's journal.
October 2nd, 5 a.m. Just returned from the empty house. Left Mina here at home. Well, we've done our work at Carfax. The place was filthy. The air stagnant and foul and alive with rats. We counted the boxes. Only 38 of them. And over each one, the professor went through his same mysterious work. It was dawn when we got back. I found Mina asleep. She looks paler than usual.
October 2nd. Soon after they left, I fell asleep. I remember hearing the sudden barking of the dogs. And then there was silence. I got up and looked out of the window. There was a thin streak of white mist moving across the grass along the wall of the house. It dawned on me that the air in the room was heavy and dank and cold. The gaslight came only like a tiny red spark through the fog. I could see through my eyelids. The mist grew thicker and thicker. Then, as I looked, the spark divided and seemed to shine on me through the fog like two red eyes.
You shall be flesh of my flesh, blood of my blood, blood of my blood.
October 2nd, 8 p.m. We're on the track. 12 boxes were delivered last week to an empty house at 347 Piccadilly.
My dear friend, until the sun sets tonight, Dracula must retain whatever form he now has. We have this day to hunt out all his lairs and sterilize them. Then he will have no place where he can move and hide. But we have only until sunset.
The house in Piccadilly was empty, like the one at Pursley. The same sickening smell was in the air. On the table we found a clothes brush, a brush, and a comb and a basin. The latter containing dirty water, which was reddened as if with blood.
The boxes are back here. 8, 9, 10... 11.
Only 11.
There's the 12th box somewhere.
Gentlemen, it is after 6. The sun is setting. We've no time to lose. He will return at any moment. Open the boxes.
Quiet. Listen. Here it is.
It is he! The window!
You waste your bullet, gentlemen. You think you baffle me? You with your pale faces all in a row like sheep in a butcher's. You think you have left me without a place to rest. But I have more. And time is on my side. The one you love is mine already. I have known her. Already my mark is on her throat. Flesh of my flesh. Blood of my blood. She is with me always. Over land or sea.
October 4th morning. Another meeting in the study of Turkey.
We must find that last remaining box, gentlemen. We must find it. As long as that earth exists impure, as long as there remains one place of refuge for Dracula, there is no safety and no peace for any soul in England.
And for the undead, never peace so long as he lives. Blood of my blood. Blood of my blood.
Mina! How do you know that?
Well, no,
quiet, quiet.
With me. With me always. Over land and sea.
Mina, darling, how did you know that Dracula said those...
I don't know. The words just came. Strange. There are times when somehow I feel that I'm with him.
At sunset?
Yes. Just at sunset. And again at sunrise. Dr. Van Helsing, if I could... If at that time, you...
Have you the courage?
Courage for what? What do you mean?
Dr. Van Helsing here will question her.
I will question her, yes. In a state of hypnosis. The one you love is already mine, he said. She is with me always, over land or sea. Ah, Count Dracula. Perhaps she will betray you if she is really with you, this one we love. Who knows? If she is really with you over land or sea.
Blood of my blood.
Mina.
Yes?
Answer me, Mina. Are you with him?
Yes, I am with him.
Where are you?
I do not know. It is all dark.
What do you hear?
The lapping of water. I can hear it on the outside.
Then you are on a ship?
Yes.
What else do you hear?
There is the creaking of an anchor chain.
What are you doing?
Still. Oh, so still. It is like death. It's like death.
Here is a report from Matson Peabody, shipbrokers. Dated October 5th, according to Lloyd's List, the only sailing ship that left for the Black Sea yesterday was the Tsarina Katrina, bound for Varna. Some hours before she sailed, a man came alongside, all in black, driving a cart with a great box in it. This he lifted down single-handed and carried below. No one remembers having seen him after that, as heavy mist came up over Doolittle Dock until sailing time. the rest of London Harbour remained completely clear.
Our plans are made. The average sailing time from London to the Black Sea is 3 weeks. We can travel overland to the same place in 3 days. We shall be there waiting for him when he arrives.
October 15th, arrived Varna about 5 o'clock. Mina seems stronger. Every morning before sunrise and just before sunset, she speaks to Van Helsing in a trance.
Are you with him, Mina? Tell me, are you with him?
I am with him.
What can you see?
Nothing. All is dark.
What can you hear?
I can hear the waves lapping against the ship and the water rushing by. The wind is high. I can hear it in the shrouds and the bow throws back the foam.
So, Tsarina Katrina is still at sea, hastening on her way to Varna. The Count cannot cross warning water, so he cannot leave the ship without being observed.
What do you hear, Mina?
Lapping waves and rushing water.
A whole week of waiting. Daily telegram from Lloyd's.
Not yet reported.
Rushing water and creaking mast. Darkness and wind.
October 24th. Telegram. Lloyd's, London to Harker. Tsarina Katrina reported this morning. From Dardanelle. Lloyd's, London to Harker. October 28th.
Tsarina Katrina in heavy fog reported entering Galatz Harbor at 1 o'clock today.
Galatz is 38 hours from here, and the first train for Galatz leaves at 6:30 tomorrow morning. My friends, we have lost.
I am with him. I can see nothing. I can hear men's voices calling, and the roar and creak of oars in the rocks. I can feel the air blowing upon me.
29th evening. We are due between 2 and 3 in the morning, but already at Bucharest, we are 3 hours late.
Something is going on. I can feel it passing like a cold wind. I can hear far off confused sounds. Men talking in strange tongues. Tears falling water and the howling wolves. There is another sound.
Like what? Speak, Mina. Speak, I command you. I command you to speak.
Arrived in Garrett's. Saw Captain Tsarina Katrina.
A man come aboard with an order an hour before sunup. Receive a box for a party by the name of Dracula. God, his peppers are right. Emmanuel Hiddleshine, his name was.
Mr. Hiddleshine?
Yes.
You went out of the box yesterday.
I gave it to Kailoff by order. Kailoff.
Mr. Kailoff?
Kailoff. This morning they find him dead inside the churchyard of St. Peter. They find him dead with his throat torn open.
October 30th evening. There are 2 ways in which Dracula can get back to his own place. By land or by water.
We've examined the map and find the most likely river is the Ceres.
You and I, Seaward, will charter a steam launch and follow him up the river. Van Helsing and Mina will take the train to Veresti, and from there they will...
From there we shall go in the track where Harker went, from this bridge over to Borgo. If you have not caught him before, we shall be awaiting Dracula there.
October 31st. We arrived at Veresti at noon, then Helsing and I. Bought a carriage here, and we start in an hour. Our enemy is still on the river.
October 31st. We can run a good speed up the river at night. There's plenty of water, and the banks are wide apart.
November 1st, evening. No news all day. We hear that a big boat went up the river before us, going at more than usual speed.
November 4th. All day driving. The country gets wilder as we go. By morning, we shall reach the Borgo Pass.
November the 4th, evening. We've left the launch. We've got horses, and we follow on the track along the river. We are armed. Look! Quick! There they are now! Heading west! With the dawn, we could see the Slovaks some miles before us, dashing along the river with their wagons. On it is the great box.
Thank you.
late in the afternoon. We reached the Burgo Pass.
Van Helsing, look, look.
We could see a long way all around us. Far off, beyond the white waste of snow, was the river like a black ribbon curling. Between us and the river, not afar off, came a group of men, mounted slow by train along. In the midst of them was a wagon which swept from side to side. On the wagon was a great box.
Look!
We see two horses following fast, coming up from the south. Stuart and Harker, the Slovaks with their heavy wagon, are losing their ground. Now the horsemen are not more than a mile behind. Now the wagon is quite close to us. We can see the gray box swaying crazily. Now they are almost upon us. Now has happened a strange thing. The wagon smashed into a great rock dead in the snow, lost its front wheels, and turned over on its side, jammed against the stone. The horses tore loose from their traces and bolted, and the Slovaks scatter and vanish after them. Then silence. Silence like comes after ringing a bell.
Look, his face.
It is Dracula. Sprawled out stiff and twisted in the smear of his own holy earth. The box, in falling, has emptied the dirt onto the snow. His face is old-looking. The skin is like paper. Dr. Seward, there's no time. Look at the sun.
Sunset.
In 1 minute there's darkness and he is forever lost to us. Have you the stake of wood and the hammer?
Here.
Now, Seward, pray for us. Kneel down and pray. Harker, the stake of wood over his heart. Be not afraid, Harker. Do not look into his eyes. The hammer. Now, Harker, strike. Strike!
Flesh. Flesh of my flesh. Guilt of my guilt. Death of my death. Speak and be manifest in the instant of your master's peril. Elements of darkness, rain, evil wind, mist, and mold, and tempest.
Right!
The others couldn't, but somehow I can hear him speaking behind his eyes.
Claw, wing, tooth, scale, tissue of flesh, death of my death, dead and undead. The hand of the living is over your master. Console him, my children. This instant is no longer than the space between two heartbeats. But the night is not here, and I am lonely. Come to your master, my children. Beguile him now in the instant of his peril. Beguile him with the sound of your names. Claw. Wing. Tooth. Scale. Tissue of flesh.
Strike, Harker, strike!
There is one very dear to me who has not answered. My love. Mina. There is less than a minute between me and the night. You must speak for me. You must speak with my art.
Give them to me! Jonathan, give them to me! The stake of wood and the hammer!
Harker!
I shall never forget that moment. The look on poor Mina's face as she stood there, the angry scar standing out on her throat, her eyes like living coals in the last red of the sunset. She had torn the stake and the hammer out of my hands with the strength of an animal.
Mina! Do you know what you've done, woman? Do you know what you've done to us? You've released him, the evilest fiend!
Look! The sun! As we looked down at Dracula, the eyes saw the sinking sun, and the hate in them turned to triumph.
Flesh of my flesh, come to me, my love. Come into the night and the darkness. You have served me well, my love. My bride, my...
Ladies and gentlemen, all the evidence in this case is now before you. I've added nothing.
and to the best of my knowledge, I've omitted nothing that might help to throw light on the extraordinary events of the year 1891, which culminated on that terrible evening in the Borgo Pass. There remains only this one last report.
When Mina Harker seized the stake and hammer from her husband, I believe she was under some form of hypnosis. She herself remembers nothing. But whatever influence was at work on her, she must, at the last moment, have rejected it. For at the exact instant the sun disappeared, it was Mina Harker who drove the stake through the heart of the thing that called itself Dracula. At that same instant, even as we looked, the wound on the side of her throat was no more. As for Dracula, before the scream of the creature had died from our ears, the whole body crumbled into dust and passed from our sight. In that final moment of dissolution, there was in the face a look of peace, such as I never could have imagined might have rested there.
Tonight's production of Dracula by Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater was the first of 9 CBS broadcasts in which this brilliant group will bring to life a series of great narratives, all presented in the immediacy of the first person singular. In presenting them each Monday evening at this time during the summer season, the Columbia Network is bringing a complete theatrical producing company to the air for the first time. And now here is the director to tell you about next week's Mercury Theater production, Mr. Orson Welles.
Ladies and gentlemen, what are your favorite stories? If there's one you're particularly fond of and would like to hear on the air, will you please write me about it? Next week, the Mercury Theater is going to tell you Robert Louis Stevenson's exciting yarn about pirates and the sea, Treasure Island. Until then, just in case Count Dracula has left you a little apprehensive, one word of comfort. When you go to bed tonight, don't worry. Put out the lights and go to sleep. It's all right. You can rest peacefully. That's just a sound effect.
There. Over there in the shadow, see?
It's nothing. Nothing at all. Nothing at all. I think it's nothing. But always remember,
ladies and gentlemen, there are werewolves. There are vampires. Such things do exist.
This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The year is 1883. The hour is late, and the mood is fear. As two exhausted human beings crash through the underbrush and into a clearing. But there is no pause in their flight, for the baying of ravening hounds is hard on their ears.
Vincent, Vincent, they're gaining on us. See, see, they come. Vincent, we're lost.
No, Erica, not if we can reach those trees yonder. Hurry, darling, just a few paces more. Hurry!
After an eternity of seconds.
That's it, darling. Climb up as high as you can.
I have a handhold, Vincent. Now, you come up.
The man knows his companion is not yet safe, and all caution is thrown aside as he reaches for a stump branch and prepares to defend his loved one suddenly.
Hold!
And like a blanket, calm enfolds the once enraged dogs, and they trot off, docile and tame as household pets, to the feet of their master.
Please, gentlefolk, do not be afraid. The dogs will do you no harm. I am to blame entirely for this terrible incident. It was senseless of me to continue hunting after the sun had gone down. Forgive me. And please allow me to make this up to you in some way.
The stranger's voice is openly friendly, but But not till Erica is safely on the ground does the man Vincent reply.
You are a gentleman, sir. But you may wish you had not so quickly called off your dogs when you learn who I am.
Then please tell me. I can stand the suspense no longer.
My name is Vincent. I am the nephew, the very proud nephew of Baron von Frankenstein. This is my fiancée, Erica.
In that case, you are the new Baron von Frankenstein, now that your uncle is dead, which entitles you to the simple hospitality of my home for as long as you may desire it. Please accompany me. You must.
If you insist. You are very kind, and we are exhausted.
With his fiancée safely mounted on the horse of their new friend, the tension of the previous few days falls away, and soon the party comes in sight of a magnificent castle.
My home, young Baron von Frankenstein, and yours, for as long as you would like to stay.
You are too kind, sir. I fear you may not know of the events surrounding my uncle's death. I feel honor-bound to tell you of them before we cross the threshold of your home.
I know the events, Baron. His experiments, the monster he created, the destruction the monster caused, and finally the enraged villagers who caused the death of your uncle. But you are merely his nephew.
Aye, merely. But a Frankenstein, nevertheless. And tainted. The villagers were not satisfied to murder my uncle. They came to my home at the dinner hour. They howled in rage as they burned my home to the ground. And in greater rage as Erica and I escaped in the confusion. We have been pursued, hounded from that moment.
Ah, here we are. My home, Hilda.
It's beautiful.
I'm glad you are pleased, mademoiselle. This ordeal must have been terrifying for you. You must think a great deal of our young Baron.
I love him, sir. And if needs be, I will die beside him. If we can just keep them from finding our... Oh, Vincent.
What Erica is most worried about is that, if it is discovered that I actually assisted my uncle at times, and know all the secrets which supposedly died with him, our pursuers will double in number and surely destroy us.
Please, Baron. Enough of this depressing talk. You shall both bathe. And after a comfortable dinner, we shall sip wine before my great fireplace, and all this will seem as though it happened in another world.
Soon the new Baron Frankenstein calmly bathes. A calm which is broken by...
Erica!
Quickly, Vincent pulls on his pants and runs from the room.
Erica! Erica, where are you? Erica!
You need go no further, Baron. What you seek is through this door.
Erica, is she in there? I thought I heard her scream. Was it Erica?
His newfound friend stands in mute silence. Finally, Vincent brushes roughly past him and into the indicated room.
What is this? It seems...
Like a blast of cold air, the full impact of the room strikes Vincent Frankenstein. The room, except for minor differences, is the duplicate of his uncle's laboratory. The room in which his uncle created what became known as Frankenstein's monster.
Explain this. No. First tell me where Erica is.
Calm down, my good Baron. This laboratory represents my failure at the same experiment your uncle succeeded at. The same experiments you will succeed at if you ever expect to see your beloved again alive.
In a blind rage, Vincent rushes past his betrayer.
Look for her if you will, fool. This castle has hundreds of rooms, dozens of tunnels, and miles of labyrinthian dungeons and torture chambers. She would starve before you could find her. That is, if I put her in an obvious place, and not behind some secret panel somewhere. No, Baron Frankenstein, you will not search for your missing Erica. You will build me a man, a slave to my will, and will start now, or your beloved Erica will never see the light of a new day.
All right, I'll do it.
To escape the torture of not knowing, Vincent hurls himself into his sleepless work, creating a living man from dead bodies, which his now hated enemy supplies in abundance.
No more bodies. I have all the parts I need. Where do you get all these bodies? And in such good condition? In heaven's name, man.
I merely want you to be happy.
I wouldn't supply you with inferior material. Am I correct in assuming that we are at the final stage?
You are correct. But we will never complete that final stage until and unless I see Erica safe and unharmed. If I don't, I'll...
Baron, please, please don't get overly dramatic. Mind your dials and gadgets like a good boy. And if you look to my left, you'll see your fiancé, safe.
Oh, Vincent!
Enough! My, assistants will guard your Erica as you work, Baron. Do not make any false moves, or they will kill her. Make no mistake about that. I am too resolved to be stopped by false heroics. Move!
With practiced fingers, young Baron Frankenstein manipulates his panel and finally throws the switch that controls the raw electricity. As the machine dies down, Vincent cranks the reclining body to an upright position.
Is he alive? Did it work? He's not moving, not breathing.
Give it some time. It could be hours before we know.
An eyelid flutters open as the two men talk.
Huh? Good Lord. He's alive and enraged.
His brain inflamed, the patchwork creature stumbles forward as his creator tries to restrain him.
Stop! Sit down! Stop!
Stop him, guards! Stop him, or it'll mean your deaths!
The two robed guards release Erica and lurch toward the raging creature.
Subdue him, Cretans, before he reaches the door!
But brute force cannot stop this monster. He smashes one guard and hurls the other with all his strength into the wall. And now he pauses. No one bars his path but the frail and beautiful Erica. Slowly he raises his eyes to hers and again moves forward.
No! Stay away from her!
Who can know the thoughts this monster has as he approaches? And now lifts the girl from the cold stone and over his head.
No!
Who can say if he thinks at all as he steps to the window ledge and hurls the girl to her death? And walks away from this now silent room, leaving a man whose mind reels and heart shrivels in his chest.
Erica! Erica! She's dead. No, she's moving, I think. Oh, help her, help her. She's alive, but broken. She looks so helpless. Count, this is your doing. Help her, please. I'll do anything to repay you. Please, I beg of you.
Without a word, the evil host steps up to the window, raises his face to the moon, and parts his lips. First, an answering growl drifts upward. Then a shadow breaks free from the darkness of the forest and trots quickly to the side of the moaning Erica. As it becomes more distinct to Vincent's unbelieving eyes, his worst dreams become reality. It has the form of a wolf, but its gray color, its bearing, implies a more fearsome presence. The presence of a werewolf.
It's attacking her, and she's helpless. No! No! Good luck!
In his hysterical state, Vincent hardly feels the hand which steals behind his neck and clenches. There is a brief shock as he slips nerveless to the floor, and blackness enfolds him. Back on the ground, Erica has survived the attack of the werewolf, and though unconscious, her breathing is regular.
There she is.
She seems so still.
Don't worry, she's alive. Torp, Bela, gather her up and bring her along.
Yes, Grandmother. All right, we've got her.
She's very beautiful, Grandmother.
Yes, now.
Hours later, Erica slowly regains consciousness.
Oh. Come, come, child, wake up. You have slept long enough. There is much to do. Wake up.
Oh, where am I? How did I get here? Oh, I've had such nightmares. What is happening to me?
You are in a gypsy camp, and I am Maliva, queen of the gypsies. And you are here to serve and make your place till the end of your days.
What? What are you saying? Oh, Vincent, where are you? I need you.
This is insane. Please, tell me, this is all a dream.
Girl, silence. This is no dream, nor will it end. You will stay here, and you will work, or you will be beaten till you beg for mercy. Now, go, and begin your chores, or so help me, the beatings will begin right now.
Move along.
All through the morning and hot afternoon, Erica toils under the cruel discipline of Bela, Maliva's grandson, as Maliva herself watches with a baleful eye.
That's it. That's it. Make her work for her keep.
Finally, as the sun goes down, Erica is allowed to rest. Chained! Weariness brings its own security, and as she begins to doze off on the ground behind one of the wagons, she fails to hear the clumsy footfalls until...
What? Who is it? Who is that?
Please. Please, Missy. Please, it's me, Torque. I would not harm you. You are like a flower. I have brought some broth. I will leave if you wish me to. I just thought...
Oh, no, Torque. Don't leave. You're right. I do need some food.
When the wolf...
Your hand! The pentagram!
Dropping the broth, Torque spins and rushes away from the helpless female, naked fear etched upon his face.
Torque, what is it? Why do you run?
The pentagram! The pentagram! And the moon is full tonight!
Erica looks at her hand, and the symbol of the pentagram which now appears there. Her mind drifts back to a poem she once heard. Even a man who is pure of heart and says his prayers by name may become a wolf. When the wolfbane blooms and the moon is shining bright. Some say Bela is insane, and the menacing whip he carries adds to this theory. Why would he beat a chained and helpless prisoner? Why does he wait till the night to accomplish his loathsome ends? As he steps into the shadows, he hears a sound which tells him that never again need these questions be asked. The sound of the werewolf.
No, stay away!
Bela turns to run. Ah! His intended victim, Erica, strikes him down with one deadly blow. No more a frail human woman. In her stead, a full-grown, enraged werewolf. Almost immediately, Bela's cry brings the gypsies from their wagons.
Werewolf!
Whoa!
There it is!
Everyone, attack!
Grab her! Pull her down!
Horrible!
You can't fight all of us! Get her!
Drag her down!
Erica's rage drives them back one at a time. Suddenly a new sound attracts everyone's attention.
It's...
Recognition fills the gypsies' eyes, and they step aside to reveal a second werewolf, a powerful gray werewolf, who now rumbles its challenge to Erica. The gray wolf attacks with the speed of thought, and soon the two half-human canines are locked in mortal combat. The savagery of their battle is insane, as every new wound they inflict repairs itself almost immediately. Unnoticed, a figure stirs in the shadows, and a grim Bela rises from the dust. Determination to gain revenge drives him to raise his pistol, and with his last breath, fire the silver bullet at Erica. It strikes the gray wolf. Confused, Erica stands and stares as the gray wolf becomes the gray Maliva. More guns and more silver bullets come into the hands of the gypsies. Erica flees into the woods. Somewhere in her animal mind, she realizes that these gypsies have battled werewolves before. So she runs. Leaving her pursuers far behind, her flight soon brings her to a somehow familiar castle. A castle whose sight draws her closer and urges her to enter. Easily, her animal form clambers to an upper window. that looks into a deserted hallway. She pauses, sniffing the air, then jumps to the floor onto all fours. She scans her surroundings at a glance, then begins padding toward the only light source, which is at the end of the hall. Human voices alert Erica.
It's no use. We'll never capture him.
Stop whining, you fool! The monster's had a full day to calm down. Help me restrain him, or you will spend yet another day in my dungeon, Baron Frankenstein.
That voice pounds in her ears. That hated voice must be stilled forever. Rage controls Erica's canine body as she hurls herself upon the master of this castle. Erica is thrown from him as though she were a puppet.
You dare! You dare lay your paws on me! On me! Low beast, you'll die for this! Die at the hands of the Prince of Darkness! For I am Dracula!
Oh, my lord, what have I done?
You, Baron Frankenstein, have done nothing but obey my will and do my bidding as I compelled you to do.
The monster stands quietly and listens also.
Do you know why you created this monster, this slave for me? Did you for 1 minute question what I would do with this creature? For this reason, Frankenstein, I am helpless in the daytime, like a sleeping babe. I need a strong, mindless slave to protect my sleep so that I might wake at night and prowl for the blood that sustains me, the blood of innocent victims to quench my undying thirst.
As though awakened from a long sleep, the monster's lip curls and he reaches out to grasp the throat of Dracula. Lifting the vampire into the air, he effortlessly dashes into the ground. Horror stretches the eyes of Vincent Frankenstein as the vampire, unhurt, rises, revealing an evil grin, and attacks the man-made monster. This man-thing was Ben's clamp once again on the throat of Dracula. Silently, each squeeze probed past neck muscles, seeking windpipe, spine, arteries.
He's swimming! Must get away!
Panic seizes Dracula, and he begins to transform himself into a giant bat.
Let go! Let go! I'm free!
Dracula frees himself and flies upward and toward Vincent, intent on escape. The face of Erica flashes through Vincent's mind. Grim determination sets his jaw as he reaches for an urn of burning embers and hurls it full in the face of Dracula. Screaming in pain, he flies upward, circles, then dives straight into the monster. Tumbling into the laboratory, the two figures smash into chemicals and equipment, which ignite into a blazing inferno.
Fire! Tremendous heat! I'll be burned alive! Maybe it would be just as well. Without Erica, I might as well be dead. No, I can't lose hope. She might still be alive.
But as Vincent turns to leave,
the werewolf blocking my path. It's confused by the fire. It'll doom us both if it doesn't move. No! I must try to reason with it. Wolf, listen to me. That fire will kill us. We must go. I can show you the way. We'll die if we stay here.
Slowly, rational thought lights the werewolf's eyes.
Don't you understand? It's stepping aside, letting me pass. It does understand. Must hurry before those chemicals explode. Hurry, Wolf, hurry. The flames are spreading. We only have seconds. We made it. No, don't stop. The whole place is about to collapse. There she goes.
Mushrooms upward and then collapses in upon itself.
'Tis done. And now, Wolf, what of the two of us? Will you try to devour... What? Something's happening. You're changing. Transforming. Becoming... familiar. Oh, Lord. Erica! Erica, my darling! How can this be? No. No, 'tis enough. You are here. Here, put on my cloak.
Oh, Vincent, it was horrible. Horrible! I can hardly bring myself to think of it.
Don't think about it for a while. Just think that we are safe and alive, and that the sun is rising on a new day. Our day.
But, my, this thing that will...
You mean your werewolfism. My love, do not fear it. I know a man, a doctor, who has cured this condition. We shall find him, and we shall defeat this thing together. We have come through a night of unending terror, and it has come to an end.
Have a good evening, and come back again next week. This has been Bill Holwick from West Texas for Broken Sea Audio Productions. www.brokensea.com. Good evening. Good evening. The music for tonight's episode was composed by Brian of Seraphic Panoply and Stevie Farnaby. Starring my groovy granddaughters, Draven Schoberg and Kyra Greenfield, and Stevie Farnaby. Happy Halloween. Mwah!